Okay, sir, if you could continue. Colonel Sylvester?
Yes.
Yeah, if you could continue, sir.
Okay. One thing that I wanted to touch on about flying, I feel that I was very fortunate, and our crews were very fortunate, in that some pilots and some crews experience less damage to the aircraft and to themselves as they became more seasoned. And I feel that if you could read the terrain, read the enemy on the ground, know your crew, and you could fly the terrain at your highest capacity of flying with experience, you were inclined to have a better success rate in going into an area and coming out of the area uninjured.
Right.
Now, some of the very best pilots in the world have been killed using good techniques. But I do feel that if an experienced combat pilot could get into LZs with less damage to their aircraft than others that had less experience, you might have to push the aircraft a little bit more, but you understood what the aircraft could do. The Huey is almost like a glove on a pilot that understands the aircraft. And I think many of our dust-off pilots and crews knew how to do that.
Right.
And they would feel the aircraft, and they could get lower in the trees and not get one blade strike. They could fly faster and sometimes almost sideways and back out of LZs that they couldn't get out any other way other than taking off backwards. Those, though, are techniques that are developed by combat flyers.
Okay. Now, did you know the exact date of when you would return home, that first tour?
No,
okay.
I didn't. And I think we found out about 2 months out from the time that we were supposed to. And I believe I left on the 22nd of February. I would have to look that up. But,
okay.
We did count the days. We were obviously concerned about the type of missions we were flying. I mean, we all had short-timers' calendars. And many people did not want to push their luck. And there were some people we know that had rocket attacks when they were sleeping in the compound in Saigon, ready to get on the Big Bird the following morning. After they had spent a year out in the boondocks in the jungles, not getting injured, but the last day in a secure compound, they were killed. And that's unfortunate, but their time was meant to be.
Sir, how did you function, in your own words, how did you function with the knowledge that any day you could die, any day that you could really have significant trouble, and you really had no control over that?
No, and some of us probably thought that we were could not be killed. But I think that some people were willing to face danger more than others and did not consider a situation dangerous, where other folks might look at the situation and say, you're absolutely crazy for doing that, and why did you do it, and be questioned. I think there's levels of confidence, there's levels of endurance, there's levels of understanding what your crews are capable of. I think that only one time I thought, no, two times that I thought of death. Mm-hmm. I really and truly thought that when the 50 caliber rounds were coming through my cockpit and in between my legs that I was dead. Mm-hmm. And that I was frightened and scared to death. Mm-hmm. The other time was because I knew the probability of having a mid-air collision and walking away from it was very low. Mm-hmm. And I thought I was dead at that time. Mm-hmm. Those are the two times that I truly was very, very frightened. Mm-hmm. And probably remember them to this day. Mm-hmm. But both times, again, typical. Everything is going by very, very slow. It's because the adrenaline that's going through your body is making your mind think and react very rapidly, which is a protective mechanism that gives you an extra edge.
Right.
And I think in both cases, experience at the controls helped both times get out of those situations and get the aircraft except for the one that crashed safely to the ground.
Right, right. Okay. How did you feel when you were able to leave Vietnam that first time?
Say again?
I'm sorry. How did you feel when you were able to leave Vietnam for the first time there in 1965?
I hope that I never had to go back. Mm-hmm. That was the main thought that was running through my mind. Mm-hmm. I could not wait to see my wife, who was meeting me in New Orleans. Our plans were to stay there in New Orleans. Mm-hmm. We ended up spending just a few hours there because we wanted to both let me see the children.
Right.
I was saddened that there were other people that had to remain in Vietnam, mm-hmm. and I was getting to go home safe. Mm-hmm. I was very naive and very proud of what I had accomplished with the troops and the men that I flew with. Mm-hmm. I was proud of the unit that I was in, the 57th. And the confidence it had given me over a year's period of time. Mm-hmm.
Why do you say you were naive?
I guess I was naive in that I did not realize what was going on in America. Okay. I was going home proud of what I was doing, mm-hmm. but I didn't know that people, when I got home, would hate what I was doing.
Mm-hmm. Now, was this the first tour?
Or yes.
Was this, okay, in 65, you felt this when you came home?
Right.
Okay. How aware of you were you of American policy and what we were doing? This is right when the buildup is starting to happen for the United
right.
States.
Right, and we felt that there needed to be a buildup. And we felt that the American people were behind us. Mm-hmm. And we felt that if all the troops came in, we would end the war rapidly. And could have, in fact, ended the war rapidly if the soldiers and the men and the troops that were put there would be allowed to fight and do what they were trained to do, instead of having policies dictated or held back mm-hmm. At the time. Mm-hmm. Now, I didn't know that was going to happen. We all thought that we were committing ourselves and we were going to be protecting our forces with more forces, because we didn't have adequate forces at that time. We were just, you know, paper thin there, and could have been overcome at any time with the Viet Cong. And in 65, they were truly moving into South Vietnam, and we were beginning to get kicked.
Right. What did you think of President Johnson?
He he did not know what he needed to do. Johnson obviously was a political animal. I really can't I cannot make an educational answer to that. I don't know. I have no comment.
Okay.
And I it's not for any political reason. I just don't think he understood the significance of what needed to be done. And that might have been the fault of the military advisors that he had. Do not think at that time the ambassador was giving him adequate information out of Saigon. They were not committed. And again, I think that in hindsight, I guess I could answer that in a different way, but from that standpoint at that time, I did not know how the American public didn't want to hear and thought we were the killers. And we were there because we wanted to be there. We were just there because we were directed to be there.
Right, right. Now, when you got back, you were relocated to Fort Sam Houston in Texas, correct?
Right.
Okay, and you were there for about, 6 months or so?
Right, I was there for a very short period of time. The 498th, when I got there, I discovered that that unit was going to be going to Vietnam in September. And so I had the opportunity of helping train that unit. We had a lot of senior-ranked people there. We had 25 captains at the time that were on the majors list to make major. Obviously, having a company with 25 majors in it was crazy. They were eventually moved to other units so the dispersion would be a little bit better. And the reason I say it's crazy, they had been in the service for a long period of time. Every one of them did not, almost every one of them had not flown a Huey, and we had to give them check rides in the helicopter because they'd flown older aircraft. So we were seeing sending people that were good aviators in other aircraft, but not necessarily great aviators in the Huey. And that could have been done better. When you get up into age, a little bit older, you just have a different perspective on things, and you probably don't want to take as many chances as some fat, dumb lieutenant is eager to do whatever he's supposed to do, but he does it because he has not experienced life as much as a senior person.
Right, right.
So it's kind of it's unfortunate that that type of thing happened on the assignments because I think that hurt us in the long run when all those pilots were getting there with the same amount of years in service that had done other things and were more concerned about their life than, again, like I say, some fat, dumb lieutenant.
Right, right. How much were you talking about your experiences in Vietnam with your wife and with your family?
I told them it was very dangerous. And at that time, I had come home fairly decorated, but I didn't know all the decorations I was going to get, so they knew that I didn't get these things handed out to me. Mm-hmm. So I had to talk about those things. Mm-hmm. They did not want me to go back. Obviously, the 498th wanted me to go over with them. Mm-hmm. I said no to that and was relocated to Fort Pope, Louisiana.
Right. There
was two of us that had come back. Bob Mock, who had been evacuated because of some medical condition midway through his tour, mm-hmm. and myself. And what we did set up a extensive training program for the medics and crew chiefs in water environments. We tried to find areas that where medics and crew chiefs would actually have to get into the water, load patients, try and simulate the conditions that we've had in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. I tried to set up training programs so that we could do night flying into LZs without lights using minimum types of equipment. Mm-hmm. That was an interesting experience. Wild Bill Harris, General Harris, who was the compound commander or post commander at that time, I had talked to him at length about some of our flying experiences, and I told him, you know, we need to set up ranges where our crews could at least fire from an aircraft and not be in a static condition on the ground firing, mm-hmm. because it was totally different. Mm-hmm. He really and truly tried to help the 498th. We had all the ranges available to us so that we could fly down the range and shoot from the aircraft, and the crew chiefs and medics would be able to have that experience and not experience it once they had to get to Vietnam. Mm-hmm. So there were some interesting training programs that were developed with me coming back to the unit, and Bob Mock and myself were able to head that up. Mm-hmm. Now, there were a lot of people, though, that were senior that said, y'all are just hot rodding. Mm-hmm. Y'all are not flying well. You're not, you know, y'all are being reckless. Mm-hmm. Well, we never tried to be reckless. What we were trying to demonstrate was that the aircraft could tolerate conditions that they were not used to flying in, mm-hmm. and that you could never make a normal approach into a hot LZ, which they were used to making.
Right.
So if we came barreling into an LZ, did a side flare by kicking in right pedal, washing out the air under the blades, and settling to the ground, they had never experienced that. In fact, they probably thought we were trying to kill them.
Right.
But those are the kinds of techniques that they had to learn and did learn, especially after they got there. They realized that there were some of us that had come back that were really and truly telling the truth. Mm-hmm. But it's easy to tell a pilot that has 200 hours under his belt to do it because, you know, he thinks it can be done if somebody's telling him it can be done. Mm-hmm. You tell somebody with 2,000 hours under the belt that it can be done, and they say, well, isn't the tail boot going to fall off?
Mm-hmm.
So it's a difference in how your perspective is on things.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's just unfortunate that many of the senior pilots went over later into the Vietnam War, mm-hmm. than sooner.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
so that they could express that at all levels of command that they had later on.
Right, right. What did you do at Fort Polk that was different from at Fort Sam Houston?
Well, I got to fly the H-19 Hog, the UH-1H reciprocating engine that flew at about 60 miles an hour versus the flight time that we did have. It helped me get back into perspective some of the things that of hard flying was with a reciprocating engine. But we basically backhauled or carried patients from hospital to hospital, people that were in automobile accidents at, you know, some place within that region's responsibility, and we'd go and pick them up from a civilian hospital and get them back to the nearest military installation. Mm-hmm. So it was really a kind of hospital transport, and we were a TO&E unit, a tactical operational unit that was ready for deployment. We would have not deployed with the H-19s. Mm-hmm. We would have deployed with new aircraft, but we had to fly the H-19s because most all the good stuff that was going to Vietnam.
Right. Right.
Now, one of the things that I had the opportunity of doing while I was there, for several months, I was TDY to Bell Helicopter Plant. And I was able to pick up every 3 days a new aircraft out of Fort Worth, Texas, and fly it to Stockton, California, which was about 10 hours and 40 minutes on one of our flight routes. They gave us 3 days, pick up an aircraft, test fly it, and fly it out to the depot in Stockton, California. And we did that every 3 days. We've dropped the aircraft in Stockton. Go to San Francisco, fly back into Fort Worth, pick up a new one, and fly out.
Okay.
And we did that, low-level, single pilot, sometimes in flights of three, sometimes in flights of five, sometimes single ship. So it was one of the most exciting ways to seeing America.
Right.
And I enjoyed it. I've flown low-level across the Death Valley. I've flown over San Bernardino Pass. I've spent the night in Yosemite National Park. I fished and slept in the aircraft overnight and RON, basically, closed my flight plan out and took off the next day. But in the 60s, you could do that.
Right.
And that was fun. Totally different than our flying in Vietnam.
Right, right.
After a short period of time in Fort Polk, then they wanted me to go back to Vietnam. I think I'd been back over a year and a half, maybe 2 years. And my concern at that point in time was, hey, where are all these guys that haven't gone to Vietnam? And why are the pilots that have already been going back again? And there was some concern there. I did volunteer to go to a short tour. I went to Korea instead from 67 to 68. Came back, went the career course, and then I went to the medical supply course, and I was beginning to set a pattern of wanting to be able to eventually get off flight status and become a healthcare administrator.
How did you decide to go career?
When did I decide to go career?
Yes, sir. And why did you decide to do so?
I'm not sure about your question. I decided to go regular Army. When I was in Vietnam, my first tour.
Okay, that's what I mean. Just decide to stay in the Army. And
yes, I liked what I was doing. I liked saving lives. I liked being in the Army, and I was proud of it.
Okay.
Of course, that was before I came back to the States.
Right, right. Did your view change when you came back to the States?
No, absolutely not. I was a cocky little lieutenant that felt like I was on top of the world.
Right.
I was proud of what I'd done, and I talked about it, mm-hmm. And I probably bragged about it.
Mm-hmm.
But I did go to Korea. I came back. I went to the Korea course. I took the medical supply course. Then I went to a place called Hunter Stewart in Savannah, Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
I was there from around March, I think, of 68.
Mm-hmm.
I think.
March of 69.
March 69, thank
yes,
you.
Mm-hmm.
And I stayed there until 70.
Mm-hmm.
And it's important. I met a gentleman by the name of Bill Bentley. He was a hospital administrator at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And Bill, I had met originally in the 498th. He had already been to Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
He was a terrific hospital administrator. I went to Vietnam in 70,
mm-hmm.
and several months after that, probably 6 or 7 months after that, he became my battalion commander, and it was a great battalion commander. I had been a unit commander, or two unit commanders, when I first got there,
mm-hmm.
on July the 1st, I think, of 70.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, Francis A. Copeland had been the battalion commander. I became second in charge of the battalion that had 55 aircraft. Francis A. Copeland was a piece of workmanship. But Bill Bentley came, and shortly thereafter, we had a crisis up in the northern part of South Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
Where there were some aviation unit commanders that were being relieved,
mm-hmm.
For not doing the appropriate thing in dust-off units.
Mm-hmm.
And I, because of my background experience, and was sent to Phu Bai, which would have been, and I had three detachments up there, which would have made five units that I was a commander of.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when Lam Sam 719 began.
Right, right. If you don't mind, sir, I'd like to ask you, before you went back to Vietnam, now you're in the States from 1965, the spring of 65, all the way until the summer of 1970. You got to see the process unfold here stateside about the reaction to Vietnam. Can you talk about a little bit how what you saw and how that made you feel?
Politically, I felt that the government wanted to get out of Vietnam and did not want to support the people that were there.
Mm-hmm.
They could not deal with the American public and the opinions that were being generated in the United States. I think that what I did not like were people that were leaving the United States trying to get away from the draft and trying to just get away from responsibilities.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think we did a good job at policing that.
Mm-hmm.
None of us wanted to fight, but we also wanted freedom of America. And the American public at the time, the consensus was that they did not want any part of it. But if policy is to support something, I'm going to be a strict soldier when I say this,
mm-hmm.
if the decision is made to do something, then we should go ahead and do it.
Right.
If the decision is to pull out, we should do that wisely. Mm-hmm. But if people are, in fact, violating the law, they should be held accountable mm-hmm. To that. Mm-hmm. I do not feel that hardly anyone was held accountable. I also feel that our POWs mm-hmm. and many people on the ground lost their lives unnecessarily because of indecision mm-hmm. that was made by our government.
Okay.
I was also disenchanted at some point in time with our Medical Service Corps because there was favoritism being displayed by people within our own ranks, mm-hmm. And they too were not being appropriately disciplined mm-hmm. By not taking responsibilities in their jobs. Mm-hmm. And I'm saying they were avoiding assignments, and they were not put out of the Army.
Right.
And they should have been. There are people that retired about the same time I did that never had the opportunity of serving their country in a wartime situation mm-hmm. in the zone. Now, if your MOS or your occupation specialty code disallows you to have to do that, then that's okay. If you're supposed to be in CONUS doing your job, and that's the only assignment there is, that's okay. Mm-hmm. They were smart in getting that type of assignment. But when you put some other people, and you're in a position whereby you can put other people in front of you and going in a rotation cycle to a hazardous area, shame on you.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I can't make any other comments.
Okay.
That are probably intelligent.
How did your family feel about you going back to Vietnam in 1970?
But their first question was, Ernie, why are you going back? Are you volunteering? Absolutely not. I'm not volunteering. Mm-hmm. They couldn't understand it. And to this day, thank God I wasn't killed.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, I know people that went to Vietnam that were killed, and it wasn't their time to go.
Mm-hmm. Wasn't their time to be killed, or wasn't their time to go to Vietnam?
It was not their time to go to Vietnam.
Okay.
They had to go because their assignment was there, mm-hmm. and they didn't have the clout to avoid the assignment, nor did they want to avoid the assignment.
Mm-hmm.
If I had been assigned the third and fourth time, I would have gone.
Mm-hmm.
And many, 90% of everybody that was had assignments, they went. I'm not saying that this was a big group of people. Probably if I really thought about it, maybe it's only 2% of the total officers.
Mm-hmm.
And I must admit, it was officer ranks that did the manipulation.
Okay.
So I'm not going to get into the civilian population and what they did or did not do.
Okay.
Thank God America gives you the opportunity of expressing your concerns
uh-huh.
and and freedom of speech will reign. I mean, that's what we were there for. Uh-huh. And I would never fault someone for saying their opinion. Uh-huh. I think, though, if they start avoiding things, then I would fault them.
Mm-hmm. What did you think of the Vietnam veterans who were part of the anti-war movement?
What did I think of the Vietnam veterans
mm-hmm.
in the anti-war movements?
Yes, sir.
They were out of service. They had made it home. They were trying to speak their peace. I do not begrudge a veteran speaking what he feels, because he lived the experience and came home. Many of the veterans that were against war had been maimed, wounded, did not have a normal life. And that's one bad thing about saving 95% of all the people you pick up in a war zone
mm-hmm.
and evacuate them, and they're saved, and they're quadriplegics, and they're amputees, double amputees, et cetera,
mm-hmm.
and are mentally incapacitated to some degree because of the war.
Mm-hmm.
I think they've earned the right to speak about not being in war and being against the war.
Mm-hmm.
Many of them were speaking because they felt that they had not gotten adequate support while they were there, and therefore they were speaking out loudly about that.
What did you think of President Nixon's plan of Vietnamization, of turning the war over to the Vietnamese?
It would have been fine if we had won the war.
mm-hmm.
But we weren't even close. We were not able to go into Laos officially.
Mm-hmm.
We were not officially able to go into Cambodia. We had not softened the enemy so that there could be a Vietnamization program.
Mm-hmm. Did you think the South Vietnamese army or the South Vietnamese military was capable of defending itself?
Yes.
Okay.
They were, but they were... there were a lot of Vietnamese rebels,
mm-hmm.
And there were a lot of Viet Cong's sympathizers, and I truly feel that they were organized in such a way that they would overcome any Vietnamese, South Vietnamese army
mm-hmm.
or air force that they had. You also have to understand, which you do, how long they had been at war.
Yes, sir.
And after a while, the old ladies and the old men that were in the rice fields, they accepted it as a way of life. They did not think that there could be change.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't have hope, you will not have a good outcome.
Mm-hmm.
You have to have faith in what you're doing, or hope in your nation. And I don't think the government of Vietnam could nurture that feeling.
Okay. When you went back in 1970, how had Vietnam changed to you?
We were then in heavy contact with Viet Cong and regular North Vietnamese soldiers. The weaponry was very sophisticated. The enemy was very sophisticated. And there was very few rebel soldiers at that time. And it was especially in I Corps and throughout Vietnam. Mm-hmm. I mean, we'd already had offensives. We were getting far more Americans wounded. My first tour, I probably only evacuated maybe at the most 100 Americans. My unit up in Can Tho evacuated in 4 months 10,000 Americans.
Wow.
And that was just two dust off detachments. That was with the AmeriCal division. There was a lot of activity up there. I mean, a lot of history was made in the AmeriCal area, but there were many, 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 many Americans killed and wounded. And, of course, when we started making the major push to try and stop the supply lines in Laos in early 70, that's when we really saw destruction. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, we had our very best up against Americans. We couldn't get on the ground officially, but we had the strongest military flight power, Air Force, Marines, Navy, and Army, trying to support that operation, and we were just getting shot out of the sky. I mean, we had SAMs being fired at us. We'd get in an LZ. We'd have direct armor tanks firing at us, direct. We had 105s firing at us and other artillery, direct, with mortar, huge mortar barrages in LZs. We had to fly and truly on the deck, and we just had nothing but small iron bullets coming up at us constantly. With SAMs, if we got any higher, that would be fired at us and home in on us. Mm-hmm. And we had to get in the trees to try and get away from SAM missiles.
Are you talking about this is Lam Song 719, or is this just in general when you went back you were making a lot of flights into Laos and Cambodia?
Well, I'm mixing 719, but the biggest fire demonstrations were obviously in Lam Song 719.
Right, right. But how much?
But the missions in the other parts of Vietnam, South Vietnam, were more intense. We had lots of hours flown. I was the commander at that time, and in Chulai, and I was flying quite a bit.
Okay.
I mean, I think I ended up with over 300 hours flying. So we were, and I was taking a lot of night time because I again continued trying to show people that it was safer flying at night than during the daytime. So I tried to take any night flight that would fly, I mean, that we had a mission on at night.
Okay. And was it normal for commanders to take to the air and fly?
It normally was, but some commanders flew more than others.
Okay. Why did you choose to fly more?
I felt that our men needed that type of mentorship.
Okay.
The reason the commanders were relieved that you could, in fact, fly in a hostile environment and get out without being blown up.
Right.
I flew in the Lonsan, I flew Lonsan 719 myself. I never took a round in my aircraft or my crew. Now, unfortunately, we flew 1,231 missions. We had hoist missions in there. We had 53. We had close to 2,382 sorties in the Laos.
Mm-hmm.
We evacuated 4,139 patients out. 1,007 were U.S. Mm-hmm. In a short period of time, did a lot. Now, unfortunately, I lost some pilots and crew. We had six KIA, nine of them, nine wounded. But almost all our aircraft, we had 69 hits in our aircraft. But we still had high availability because as soon as one got shot down, they'd give us a new one.
Right.
But that was the most intense, again, Lonsan 719, the most intense fly under hazardous conditions that I have ever seen.
Do you remember any specific incidents that happened during that operation?
No. I was scared all the time.
Really?
I wasn't scared. I think if you're scared, you get killed. Mm-hmm. I knew what I was doing. I knew that my crews were competent. I never let my guard down. Mm-hmm. And our crews never let their guards down. People didn't mind flying with me as a crew.
Mm-hmm.
I had my track record was okay.
Mm-hmm.
I stepped out of the aircraft every time I went out.
Mm-hmm.
But there were many crews that were just absolutely superb. And we had, when we'd go into the LZs, we had 3 seconds. We'd count the three and we'd pull pitch. And we had lots of people on board. And they surely, even when they were injured, did not need assistance when we were on the ground because they were getting on board the aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
Because they knew that if they got on, they might live. If they stayed there, they would die.
You evacuated a significant number of Americans from the ground
right.
in Laos. Were these special forces or regular army? Or
most of them were aircraft crews.
Okay.
There was nothing in those days published about certain units that were well inside Laos and Cambodia.
Right.
More is being written today,
mm-hmm.
has been written in the last 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
We typically did not know about those long-range patrols, even though we did sometimes go a long way out into an area that we typically never flew, and we typically did it on a hoist mission
mm-hmm.
when they chopped out a hole for us to get a jungle penetrator in to get people out.
Mm-hmm.
But they normally never told us where they were at.
Right.
But the Americans that we evacuated were typically crews that had been wounded or the aircraft shot down that we were picking them up.
Mm-hmm. Did you think the United States was doing the right thing by going into Laos and trying to cut the Ho Chi Minh Trail there with this Operation Lonsan 719?
They should have done it a lot sooner.
Mm-hmm.
in. It was they tried to be very secretive about it. Mm-hmm. There's stuff that I have in there about on the articles I put together mm-hmm. that I don't think we were logistically ready to be able to go in.
Okay.
But I think the pilots and the people that were on the ground in Vietnam tried their level best to do what they could with what they had.
Mm-hmm. How did you find the morale in your unit and the people under your command?
In every unit that I was in, the morale was very, very high. I never, and it's still high today. I mean, you can talk to our dust off association meetings that we have.
Mm-hmm.
I think we have a little over 1,500 people that meet every year
mm-hmm.
in Fort Sam Houston or in San Antonio, Texas.
Mm-hmm.
It was high then, and they still talk about how good they liked or how much they liked being in those units.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to have to take a break.
Okay. We'll end it for today then, sir.
Okay.
This is Richard Verone, and I'm continuing my oral history interview with Colonel Ernie Sylvester. I am in Lubbock, Texas, again in the Special Collections Library interview room. It's now November 19th at 8:35 a.m. Central Standard Time, 9:35 a.m. Eastern Time. Colonel Sylvester, we left off, we had begun talking about Lam Som 719, but before we jumped to 1970-71, let's talk about the spring of 1965. You had helped train the 82nd Medical Detachment there at Sauk Trang, and you were getting ready to rotate back to the United States, back to Fort Sam Houston. So what was happening there for you in March 1965 in Vietnam?
Good morning.
Good morning.
One of the things that I really remember, obviously, once the new pilots had come on board, and we had 10 active pilots. We still were using commissioned officers at that point in time mm-hmm. in the Vietnam effort. That's a key point because, again, we had very few Medical Service Corps pilots that could take on the mission of flying
mm-hmm.
In Vietnam, and we were beginning to see ourselves coming and going at that point in time.
Okay.
There had been some discussion of the warrant officers sitting with at least a commission officer in flying medical evacuation choppers.
Mm-hmm.
Later, obviously, we were able to get quite a number of warrant officers to fly, and there was not a requirement to have a commission officer flying with the warrant officers, and the warrant officers had done a wonderful job. That's a little sidebar. In regards to the ending of my first tour, after January and February had I had entered into the February month, I had really started not to fly as much as I had been
mm-hmm.
For several reasons. People and myself, I wanted to make sure that I did make it home. But my last few days with the unit was giving instructor pilot training to the new officers that had been there since October at that point in time, but there were still other officers that were coming in to take some of our places with the people of rotation,
mm-hmm.
such as Cy Simmons that had departed, and Bruce Zink, who had been a pilot during that period of time, and myself. So there were at least three replacements that had to occur prior to our departure. So I had that of training those new pilots and ensuring that they could fly safely, eventually giving them aircraft commanders flying time and initiating a write-off if they could, in fact, meet those qualifications.
Sir, if, when you train these pilots, would you take them actually into LZs, or would you train them there near the base?
We did very little training at the base at Sauk Trang.
Mm-hmm.
We might do a few auto rotations, simulated auto rotations, but the training that I was trying to instill in any of the older pilots that had been there, as far as longevity goes,
mm-hmm.
Were to ensure that they understood the true meaning of tactical flying, being able to use the terrain to meet the needs of cover, and be able to extract patients out of an LZ without getting your aircraft or your crew shot up. And again, one of my goals were to not to have anyone wounded on board my aircraft,
right.
Even though I might have been a junior pilot at that time. I had probably the most experience as flying in combat and,
mm-hmm.
in those days. So that was my goal. And there were some pilots that would go into an LZ and come out looking like Swiss cheese.
Mm-hmm.
Other pilots that might be able to go in that same LZ could come out of a hot LZ without receiving any rounds. Now, I don't know if that was luck or just coincidence. I really would not want to challenge anyone's flying, but it seemed to me that if a pilot's technique was developed, that they had, number one, they spent less time on the ground, therefore his crew was thoroughly familiar what to do on the ground with very little hesitation.
Mm-hmm.
And also the crew knew how to give you discussions of where the enemy was at and critical points of getting into a tight LZ, and therefore there's not any type of damage on the aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
So I do feel that experience could, in fact, help in a situation and save your life.
Right.
For a long period of time, in my second tour, I was considered a cherry because I never really took any hits.
Sir, if I could ask, what made a good dust-off pilot? Helicopter pilot, or in other words, when you say experience really helped a lot, which is very logical, would it vary from pilot to pilot, depending, you know, how much experience this particular pilot would need, or was there a set number of missions that he would go on, say, you know, after 10, you would consider this person experienced, or did it really vary person to person?
I think it varies person to person. I think number one, if a pilot had common sense and was able to take in all the information that he may receive from the ground unit and interpret that in such a way that his flying would be tailored to that particular LZ. To go into an LZ exactly the same way as we have been taught in school as far as landing in a controlled landing and in a combat zone was absolutely totally different.
Mm-hmm.
You may have to be on a straight and level, for example, going into an LZ and then immediately take some very erratic movements maneuver yourself into an area whereby you would not come in danger of hostile fire. I think knowing your aircraft, being able to, it's like driving a sports car. Mm-hmm. A racer knows exactly where his body of his air, of his race car is, and can get very, very close to the environment around him without putting him into a spin. And likewise, you know exactly when you're sitting in a helicopter and you're experienced, you know exactly where the skids are at. You know exactly where the rotor blades are hitting the path of the circle. Mm-hmm. And therefore, you can get your aircraft down into the surrounding vegetation and have very good cover and concealment. And you'll also have to fly well out in front of your aircraft. You can't fly just beyond your windshield. You mm-hmm. have to know what you're going to have to do well enough to, number one, give your crew an alert, because when you're going into an LZ, you're talking to the crew. You're telling them what you're doing. And the reason you do that is so that they're not fearful of what is going to take place. They understand what is going to take place. Mm-hmm. I think the unknown is what is the scariest thing about combat.
Would you tell them, like, right, when we go into this LZ, I'm going to do such and such maneuvers, or when you figured out when you're approaching an LZ, which maneuvers would work for you, would you tell them what you're going to be doing so they knew the pitch of the bird?
They are normally a good crew. The pilots are talking to the crew and talking to his stick mate. Mm-hmm. And the pilot and the AC are on the controls together, so that if one of the pilots are wounded, or maybe even both of them are wounded, but one is less severe than the other, that the other pilot can immediately take over the aircraft and either continue the flight or abort the flight to try and save the crew. Mm-hmm. But by telling the crew what is occurring, they can give you better information about the LZ and the surrounding terrain. Mm-hmm. They can also say, we're picking fire up at 3 o'clock, mm-hmm. And that might have been the way that we were, in fact, going to go after so many hundred feet mm-hmm. Of flying over the terrain. So I think what really made dust-off crews as effective as they were the people that were sitting without any controls behind them and behind the pilots, and that was the medic and crew chief.
Okay.
They were always exposing. I mean, they said we sat in a fishbowl by having all the glass up front, mm-hmm. but they were sitting in a fishbowl too. They were hanging out the doors. They were very, very much aware of the capability of the aircraft. They were very aware of the pilots that were flying. And I don't think anyone ever refused a mission because they didn't want to fly with someone. They just, I think we had enough rapport with each other that we trusted each other's talents or capabilities.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, how did you get transferred back to Fort Sam Houston in Texas?
We were getting, in those days, orders about 60 to 90 days from departure from Vietnam. Mm-hmm. So we knew where we were going. I was excited, one, that because Fort Sam Houston, we always kind of called it the country club of the Army, mm-hmm. Because that's where all the physicians and nurses and other MSCs were, and the basic training, et cetera. So it was not like a Fort Benning or Fort Knox or Fort Hood. And people really and truly kind of enjoyed themselves while learning learning their skills. But I was excited. I know that Beth was very excited about going because she had not been there when I was in the basic course, and I had told her so much about the parks and the zoos and the little train rides and the sunken gardens and the beautiful flowers and all the nice things that were there in San Antonio, Texas. So we were real excited about going there. But before we before I got there and on my way home, Beth and I had decided that we'd meet in New Orleans. We had wanted to, and before I talk about New Orleans, Paul Bloomquist, who was the chief operating, the executive officer of the 57th Medical Detachment that I had been with initially, along with Tom Christie, who was then the executive officer of the 57th, and a guy by the name of Spec 4 Bill Hughes, took me to the plane to get on it to go home. And Paul Bloomquist was just a very dynamic, wonderful person that had spent... he was working on his second tour, a continuous tour in Vietnam, and had an awful lot to offer. His nickname was Bear. And then, of course, Tom Christie was a nice gentleman also. But it was good to have, I was finally a first lieutenant at that time, but to have a major and a captain, senior captain about ready to make major, take the time to escort their youngest officer that they had had with the detachment before I had transferred to 82nd to the airport, because we really didn't, we couldn't spare that kind of people just doing those kinds of things. So to me it was an honor or a privilege to have soldiers like that take the time. I know that that same type of effort or esprit is not necessarily developed in peacetime units. And I think the esprit that's developed in a wartime situation far outlasts anything that ever would occur in a peacetime situation.
I've heard that very much from other veterans.
In fact, pilots that I knew, Cy Simmons, Bruce Zink, Pat Brady, Paul Bloomquist, Tom Christie. Paul, unfortunately, was killed in Frankfurt when he was walking up to the officers' club in a terrorist bombing several years after that. But he was a great man. He's being inducted into the Hall of Fame this year also. Tom Christie, Cy Simmons, Bruce Zink, Bob Mock, Jerry Shaw, all of us that were there some 40 years ago still write on a daily basis to each other by email nowadays, and other people like Jay McGowan, Jeff Grider, Sergeant Allen, and Specialist Hughes still communicate. And we communicate as equals today. We weren't, you know, we didn't break the officer enlisted ranks in those days. We were very, we understood what our crew was there for, and they did an excellent job, but we always kept that separation, even though we would stick our lives out on a stick if it was necessary to save their lives.
Mm-hmm.
But today we're equals, and we talk about things that have occurred in those days.
Mm-hmm.
But Beth and I had decided that we'd meet in New Orleans. Of course, since I had been gone, I had had a baby daughter,
mm-hmm.
and my son had turned a year old. So my daughter had been born on November the 13th, so she was almost 6 months, I guess, when I went home to, or at least to New Orleans. And we had planned on, Beth and I, to, number one, meet at the hotel, spend 4 days there away from her family because she was staying, had spent the time with her mom and dad
mm-hmm.
when I was in Vietnam at their home. After we had met at the hotel and talked and shared memories together, after probably about 4 or 5 hours, we decided, heck, we don't want to stay in a hotel. We really want to get home and see the kids. And that's what we did. We jumped into our car, and we drove back to Gulfport, Mississippi, so I could share the children.
Right, right. How long did you have off until you had to report to Fort Sam Houston?
We had... I took the full 30 days,
mm-hmm.
and that was good. Now, you never had that opportunity other than in the military, being able to take that many days off. But it's nice to recoup. Now, one of the things that very few people knew of folks that were in Vietnam and coming home to Gulfport, Mississippi, where I basically grew up, it was, in a way quite a deal, even though there was a great deal of anxiety apparently being generated. Now, again, I didn't know that at that time, but I had an opportunity of going on TV. Again, I thought that was quite an experience for a local guy coming home and talking about my experiences in Vietnam. And at that point in time, I had received some awards that our crew had performed in certain rescue missions. But I talked about... I think the qualities of the Vietnamese, the good qualities of the country, and I talked about the few, and we had about 5,000 soldiers and air aviation people there in Vietnam at the time when I was there.
Mm-hmm.
A very small contingent.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And therefore... that people were interested in what was occurring, and they wanted to see if I was telling a story that was different from the story that was beginning to unfold across the United States about why we shouldn't be in Vietnam.
Right.
So, in a way, that little bit of... touch of the public in Mississippi and in Louisiana was somewhat good
mm-hmm.
From my perspective.
Mm-hmm.
They did not personally mistreat me
mm-hmm.
As a professional soldier. Now, that did change a little bit in other parts of the country later on. Especially when I went back for my second tour.
Okay.
Now, after spending a lot of time with my family, Joe, my son, he's a junior, and Sandy, our oldest daughter, and Beth's family, and my family, my mother, my father, my sister, all in Gulfport, Mississippi at that time, and also Beth's grandmother. Now, Beth's father and mom, he had been in the service, the Second World War, mm-hmm. also the Korean War, and he, I think, understood, obviously, us returning from Vietnam. I think that softened the blow because we really didn't necessarily talk about Vietnam. We just talked about being together as a family. And we shared good experiences. I ate plenty of food. I ate almost anything that I liked in the past because everybody was trying to welcome me home mm-hmm. from my family standpoint. Mm-hmm. There were one or two articles that appeared in the newspaper because of, I guess, such a short period of time of me being away from Gulfport, Mississippi, and Hattiesburg, Mississippi. So both of those newspapers ran articles about my return.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And for some reason, one of the things that had been misreported at the time, that I had actually been killed in Vietnam, and there were some misunderstandings in regards to that. So obviously people were shocked to see me in some cases mm-hmm. because they thought I had been killed.
How did that happen? How did they report that you had been killed?
The only thing that I could figure out at the time was that there had been one report of my mid-air collision of December 31st, 1964,
mm-hmm.
that was reported because they one or two people that I had talked to had seen. Now, I never saw the article. I tried to find the article, but I never saw the article.
Okay.
But I think that was the misreport that they had seen that I had been in a mid-air collision with a fixed wing, and they had just maybe assumed that, mm-hmm. even though it wasn't reported,
mm-hmm.
that I walked away from it, that I was dead.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. It may have been an assumption versus a statement of fact.
Okay.
As we spent time, we spent time fishing. We spent time walking on the beach. We spent time playing with the two children, both obviously at 1.5 years old and 6 months old. And then we started preparing a few things that Beth had at Gulfport with her mom and dad and her grandmother and her brother, Michael. We prepared to go to San Antonio, Texas, and we were able to, we traveled at night going to San Antonio. San Antonio in those days was well over 12 hours. There was not Interstate 10, but an old Highway 90 that used to go across country.
Mm-hmm.
And we traveled at night because that way the children could sleep. And we had we didn't have safety belts in those days. We had a baby crib mattress in the back end of my red Pontiac Catalina convertible,
mm-hmm.
And they slept on that. And then we had one cat, Pie Wacket, a Siamese,
mm-hmm.
and we drove cross country. And I did it over the night time and arrived in San Antonio, Texas, the following morning, and reported to Fort Sam Houston.
Okay.
The 498th was just beginning to receive a lot of people. In fact, in that unit, as I may have mentioned before, there were 25. No, excuse me. There were 50 officers that flew as pilots.
Mm-hmm.
There were 25 aircraft. A company of 498 could, in fact, break into four platoons, a headquarters and headquarters platoon, and three other platoons, each with six aircraft.
Okay.
There was one additional aircraft, the 25th aircraft, which was basically a command and control aircraft for the commander. At least that was my perception of how it would be broken out.
Now, what were your duties there at Fort Sam Houston?
Since I was a first lieutenant and I was just getting back, I didn't really have any major duties. I think one of the duties, unfortunately, that many people with low rank get would be you'd have to have an officer of the day,
mm-hmm.
which is a temporary type assignment. You'd have to pull some duties at the group, inventory control officer, doing property inventory, that kind of thing. But obviously there were two pilots that had just returned from Vietnam. Bob Mock, Lieutenant Bob Mock, he had been in my flight class, had gone over to Vietnam with me, had been evacuated out of Vietnam after about 4 months of being in Vietnam and been evacuated to Japan and then later to the United States. And he hit the United States about the same time I was arriving back after a completed tour.
Mm-hmm.
But at that time, Lieutenant Colonel Joe Madrano knew or had been given a alert that his unit would be going over in August, September, October time frame from San Antonio. And that was the sole purpose of it being formed in Fort Sam Houston, and that they were being equipped with brand new UH-1Ds, the latest model of Huey, to come out from Bell Helicopter Plant. One of the things that I had responsibility of doing, since very few people were trained in a turbine engine Huey, or in the Huey model at all, and may it be the A, B, or now D,
mm-hmm.
They had to be trained and become, have an orientation flight, be checked, have a check ride made, and all of that had to be done. So one of my tasks was go to Fort Worth at Bell Helicopter Plant and start picking up aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
So Bob Mock and I were the only two pilots at that time that were rated in the Huey. So we did that.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd make one ferry run, say, in a day,
mm-hmm.
get the aircraft, they'd be checked out at the unit, and then we started training pilots to be able to fly the Huey, and we gave them transitional training, IP training, and signed off on them.
Okay.
Now, they didn't get the 25 hours that we had gotten in flight school in a Huey as a part of our training. Most of them probably got 4 hours of training. The Huey was very forgiving. If you use the manual to start your engine and do your pre-flight, et cetera, Any good pilot could do that. These were seasoned pilots that had been flying reciprocating engines for a long period of time. So they knew an aircraft. They knew helicopters. They knew the requirements that we had to go through, the procedures on any helicopter. May it be a turbine engine, reciprocating engine, tandem rotor rated, or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So as we got the pilots trained, then more of us would ferry the aircraft from Fort Worth down to Fort Sam Houston.
Okay.
And that wasn't a long flight. It was probably, at the most, 3 hours. I can't remember the time it took us, but it's not a long flight from Fort Worth, Texas, to mm-hmm. San Antonio, Texas, in a Huey. We were able to get a full complement of 25 aircraft in place. Many of the people that were aircraft mechanics had not even had formal training as in a Huey. They were being trained as the aircraft arrived. We did have new people that had just come out of aircraft mechanics school that had been trained at Fort Rucker, Alabama. And those were the crew chiefs that were being put on board these aircraft. Now, so we had the basic load of crew chiefs is one crew chief per aircraft. And then the basic load of medics is one medic per aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
So we had that many basic mechanics and medics. Then we had senior sergeants that were in charge, technicians that were in charge of each of those groups.
Mm-hmm.
We did a lot of link training. We did a lot of flying, putting aircraft time, training time on the aircraft. I knew that the people needed to learn tactical training. Lieutenant Colonel Joe Madrano was keenly aware that that experience had to be passed on to the pilots. And Bob Mock and I had primarily that responsibility to give them tactical training.
How receptive were these younger pilots to you and Bob, who had been in Vietnam?
The pilots that it all depends in their personality.
Okay.
Let me start there.
Okay.
There are some pilots that are just really cocky. Now, most pilots are cocky.
Mm-hmm.
But there are some that feel that they already know as much as they need to know. And they don't need some greenhorn to train or try and show them techniques that they prefer not doing because they might at times think it's hot rodding. However, they really didn't have a choice. They never told me that to my face or Bob Mock. They probably talked amongst themselves about the techniques that we were trying to demonstrate to them. But I know that the pilots that had maybe not 1,000 hours under their belt were much more approachable. They wanted to learn the aircraft. They were having, in some cases, enough trouble just understanding the turbine engine and how much power it had and how many patients could be picked up and the capabilities. Now, and I talk about capabilities. Sometimes if you really don't understand a machine, you will not use the capability to its built capacity.
Right.
Therefore, you were underutilizing an aircraft. If you only put four patients on board an aircraft, because that's the way you're used to flying an aircraft, then there's problems there. There's problems in some folks moving forward with changes in technology.
Did you ever have a problem adapting to the changing technology yourself?
No. Okay. I personally don't think so.
Okay.
I was very interested in flying. And most of the people that are pilots, and I guess I have to kind of clarify what I've said, all the pilots that I knew in that particular company, almost without exception, loved to fly. They wanted to fly, and they were eager to fly. And they didn't care what aircraft they flew. Now, there are some pilots, though, that would prefer not flying at night, for example, and would express that because they had not had the requirement to fly at night. They'd prefer postponing a flight until daylight if they could get that type of approval for a delay. Now, it's not a criticism on their part as far as being a good aviator. It might be a criticism on the system never requiring them to do that type of flying. The Huey was a fully instrumented aircraft. You could fly under some pretty bad weather conditions if you had instrument-rated pilots on board the aircraft. Now, I must say, though, there were very few pilots other than the people that had gone to fixed-wing school and had fixed-wing training that had instrument flying experience other than in a link trainer. Because the OH-23 and the H-13 surely were not instrument-type aircraft. Now, the UH-34 and the UH-19 were instrument-rated aircraft, but flying in weather conditions was probably not preferred in those aircraft.
Okay.
Now, some of the things that we trained in.
Is this the same kind of thing that you would do at Fort Polk as well?
Yes.
Okay.
But at Fort Sam, we trained at night. We trained going into very small, tight landing zones at night. In those days, we didn't have night vision goggles, so we tried to teach the pilots how to read the signs, read the shadows, read the light, know when you were going below the horizon. If it was dark out in front of you, all of a sudden gone below the tree horizon and need to climb. Understanding how to read your radio for homing signals, refreshing on those types of techniques of what you had in your aircraft that you'd be using in Vietnam. Learning how to shoot a flare out the side door and do a circle in mountainous terrain and not be blinded by the flare, but use the flare to fly a little bit further into an area that was unknown to you. Those techniques were learned.
Mm-hmm.
Learning how to load litters on board aircraft in water surroundings. Knowing how to even tie rope to your skids to try and pick up aircraft that have been crashed and you're trying to get patients out of the aircraft. Techniques that were common sense kind of things that you would learn by experience. We started experimenting with a hoist in those days. We did not have a hoist when I first was in Vietnam in the aircraft. Hoist missions are very, very dangerous. Hoist missions at night are beyond very, very dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
Number one, you're trying to put a jungle penetrator into an area with trees that you could get tangled up in, and you could, in fact, get some form of vertigo and be pulled into the trees if you started moving left or right backwards with your aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very difficult to do at night. During the daytime, you're a sitting duck while you're just above the trees for small arms rounds, rockets. We've had several ships shot down because of rockets going through the aircraft and unfortunately killing our crews later on in Vietnam. But we learned those type of techniques. We also had a general that was the post commander at that time. He was a one-star that I had the opportunity of meeting when I first got back because he had given me some of either the second or third DFC that I earned, and I think a Purple Heart and some other ribbons. His name was Wild Bill Harris, and number one, he wanted me to be his pilot for his Huey as a aide pilot for the commanding general. I was fortunate enough not to do that, but he did say, anything that you want or your company wants for training, just let me know, and I'll make sure that we get you ready to go to Vietnam. And he told that to my commander and to myself. But we used the range to fly crews, and at this point in time, we had enough crews to fill an aircraft, and we trained on the range, firing using four or five ranges side by side to be able to target practice, letting our crews understand how the trajectory of the rounds go if you're moving forward yourself. And they basically make an arc that is 90 degrees eventually when they come out of your weapon, they arc into a target. So it's not, you have to learn how to fire with tracers from a moving aircraft to understand how to hit a target.
Right.
Now, why target practice if we're, I mean, we were under the Geneva Convention, why should we even have weapons? And I'll say that the weapons that we had primarily were to protect the patients. But we did have our crews, if we were receiving fire, to shoot suppressive fire,
mm-hmm.
if nothing else, make noise in the back
mm-hmm.
back of the aircraft, making the enemy feel like we were at least firing back. But now, there were other units like the 101st that did put M60s on their aircraft later,
mm-hmm.
But I personally was not for that. I felt that our weapons should only be there for the protection of patients.
Did you get to choose how you would outfit the weapons on your helicopter?
That was... if you were a divisional unit, you had that choice.
Mm-hmm.
And they typically armed the aircraft.
Okay.
But in our smaller detachments, the six aircraft and our detachment commanders, we were attached to divisions or whatever, and we chose not to put larger weaponry on our aircraft.
Okay.
It was just across the board.
Okay. Tell me about what you did at Fort Polk. You go there in August 65, and you're there for almost about 2.5 years.
Right.
And you transfer to the 50th Medical Detachment.
Right. Let me tell you a little side part of that, though.
Sure.
When I got my orders to go to Fort Polk, Beth and I were getting ready, and the day before, just like my very first tour to Vietnam, I got a request for orders to go to Okinawa for a short period of time. Of course, the problem was, and it was an urgent requirement for me to go to Okinawa.
Mm-hmm.
We were moving that day. The movers were there, and my wife was going to be stranded, either going to Fort Polk by herself or whatever, but we decided she should go home because I didn't know how many days I would be in Okinawa and that my shipment would just go ahead to Fort Polk without us. I went to Okinawa for a general court-martial of a doctor, Dr. Wolf, that had refused certain things in Vietnam in Soc Trang. He was one of the doctors with the first surgical unit or surgical hospital that went into Vietnam. And Dr. Wolf had refused numerous things and was getting a court-martial that I was supposed to be a defense witness for. The problem is, unfortunately, they realized that I was actually a hostile witness and I could not substantiate what they wanted me to substantiate in regards to his actions. And they were trying to indicate that he was really a brave doctor and was just refusing to do certain things. And it was not because his lack of bravery. And what he was trying to prove, he and I, from time to time, would go into Soc Trang, and I was kind of driving for him, and he would treat patients downtown in Soc Trang, and he was trying to say that if he did that downtown, he was not afraid to be in combat, and that was not the reason that he was shirking duties on the compound. I don't recall the outcome. I think he was not, he did not receive the general court martial, but he ended up getting out of the service shortly thereafter. That took about 5 days, I think. I was in Okinawa. Then I went back to Gulfport. I picked up my wife and children. And we drove to Fort Polk, Louisiana.
Okay. What were your main duties there at Fort Polk?
My first duty was to fly UH-119s.
Okay.
George A. Morius was the commander at that time. George A. Morius happened to be a pilot, but he was grounded because he had a continued vertigo. He was one of the pilots that did not go to Vietnam because of medical conditions.
Okay.
Dick Anderson was a pilot. Myself and a few other pilots that I can't remember at the time. I'll fill that in later for you. But my primary duty was to fly patients throughout Arkansas, Louisiana, Mississippi to recover the patients that were either military sponsors or family members of military or retired that were either in auto accidents or became ill while they were away from the installation, for example, Fort Poe. So we would get a mission from the hospital where the regulator, the medical regulator, was to go and pick up, say, patients that were in an automobile accident while on leave in the New Orleans area. Mm-hmm. And we'd fly the old H-19 down to that particular area, mm-hmm. round robin, bring the patient back to the closest medical military facility. Now, if he happened to be Air Force, we would try to get that patient back into an Air Force medical facility. Mm-hmm. And obviously, if it was Army, then we would fly him back into Fort Polk.
Right.
But that was one of our basic missions. We were a TO&E unit, and we were on a high category of alertness for any uprising that might occur in the world. They. If, for example, in today's time, if a unit had to move out to Iran or Iraq, that unit would be tagged and would be airlifted or air-railed to port and unloaded onto the ships to go to that particular point. So we had had to be in a very high alert status of readiness. Mm-hmm. So we were always preparing our unit, making sure our equipment was ready, and we would use those H-19s, even though they were reciprocating engines, for a period of time until they probably would get Hueys to us. We had boxes already prefab that we would put TO&E equipment into, tents, parts, all of that would be prepared, numbered, tagged, etc. And we would go through training exercises of loading up on the rail for movement. Mm-hmm. And the years that we were there, we got the outstanding ratings each time we were rated. One of my first jobs that I really and truly had to do for the military other than fly mm-hmm. was be a property management officer.
Okay.
So I had to keep, or they called it in those days, property book officer. Mm-hmm. I had to know and make sure that everybody was accountable for their equipment. And we had the old hand receipts, and we'd have all the equipment going out and being signed for by each individual in the unit that had responsibility, direct responsibility for that equipment. Mm-hmm. And I basically maintained a property book, ensuring that that documentation was accurate. And that was checked, and we had annual general inspections by the Inspector General of the post or by the Army Inspector General. And these were not notified inspections. We would get a call at 4 o'clock in the morning mm-hmm. that our unit was being inspected. So we never knew when that would occur. Mm-hmm. But each time we truly were at the best rating on the installation. And we always were one of the few units that ever got outstanding ratings each time they reviewed us. Mm-hmm. In addition to that, we would support or help train or be a reviewer for the National Guard to train. So if, for example, the National Guard that was for the Louisiana National Guard or the Arkansas National Guard, mm-hmm. whoever was in that Army area, if they had an exercise, a field exercise, one of our officers, and I did it on many occasions, mm-hmm. number one, because I was one of the junior officers, we would go out and oversee the actions that took place with that medical unit, and we would typically review medical units and sometimes aviation units. In addition to that, we would, our cadre or our unit would be the opposing force, where we would simulate attacks, air attacks, chemical attacks, all those types of things mm-hmm. there. Now, another thing that occurred during that period of time in the years that I was stationed there, mm-hmm. The expert medics badge was first introduced during that period of time. Now, the expert medics badge is equivalent to the expert infantry badge that the combat arms had in existence for years. Mm-hmm. But the medical department had never had that as a part, it never had that badge as an item that could be sought after. We at Fort Polk were part of a pilot program to test for that and try and qualify or pass mm-hmm. the test. I was one of the first five people that qualified for that particular award. Okay. In fact, I had all of us, the five that got it, had a difficult time even getting a badge because they hadn't made the badge yet. The only thing that they did have was a combat medics badge mm-hmm. that some of us went ahead and actually fabricated and cut off the reef off the combat medics badge to make the expert medics badge that we knew it was going to be fabricated in the same design. Mm-hmm. So that's how we were able to wear our expert medics badge before it was ever fabricated by the sources that had that contract for the Army. Mm-hmm. But I got very good training, flying training there. One of my other assignments that our unit had responsibility for was the Eglin Air Force Base. That's Inc. I'm not sure about the name of the Air Force Base. I believe it's pronounced Eglin. But
that's right.
And it was just north of Fort Polk. Mm-hmm. And we went to Mena, Arkansas, a crew, mm-hmm. and we'd be on standby. And this went on for probably 6 months. On standby every day while the Air Force did low navigational bombing run practices from the Air Force Base at Alexandria, Louisiana, up to Fort Smith, Arkansas. Mm-hmm. And they were, it was a corridor they would run or fly at around 200 feet above the terrain from Louisiana all the way up to Fort Smith and then turn around and go back. Now, luckily, we never had an accident. Because in the Razorback country of Arkansas, our H-19, we could probably find the crash site. We could direct people into the crash site, and we might could land on a highway, but the sure fact of us trying to land an H-19 into rugged terrain like that would probably be very close to being impossible. So, you know, we talked about the rationale behind that, but we never got off the mission. I mean, it was just a requirement that we had to be there. But MENA, Arkansas's airstrip was a dirt strip, and we had a crew chief, a medic, and a pilot sitting there on that dirt runway from around 7 o'clock in the morning until around 3 or 4 in the afternoon, every day, 7 days a week. And we did rotate that, but that was very boring.
Okay, sounds like it.
That was one of our duties and responsibilities there.
Now, had you decided at this time to make a career out of your Army
Yes.
deployment?
Okay. When, in fact, going back to 64, when Colonel Hamrick, who then was the Corps Chief, had come over to visit us in October of 64, I talked to him about becoming a regular Army officer. And I applied for that at that time.
Okay.
And shortly after returning to Fort Sam Houston, I received my regular Army commission.
Okay.
So I was very happy and never unhappy with any assignment that I ever received as long as I was in the service.
How much did you follow what was happening in Vietnam while you were at Fort Sam Houston and Fort Polk, and then in Korea?
You know, I probably, again, was probably very shallow in my thought process about what was going on from a national standpoint. What the pilots and the different people that were in at Fort Polk, for example, were concerned about that we were, some of us that were back less than a year had already been asked to go back to Vietnam.
Right.
And I would say that there was a concern for the pilots that were first there that senior people that were in the Medical Service Corps, and I'm going to put a number on this, of about 300 pilots in the Corps at its greatest capacity, we were going to be chosen to go back when there were many, many people that had not even been looked at or had reasons not to go. And that was disenchanting to us that had experienced Vietnam. And the longer you stayed away, you know, when you're young and foolish, I think wars, unfortunately, are a better fought with young people because they feel in non-destructible.
Right.
Right. And they have not developed strong ties with their families.
Okay.
And that concerned us. And what concerned us at Fort Polk, for example, we had a senior officer, the commander, that had an illness that was preventing him to be considered to go to Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
It also puzzled us that a senior aviator would be filling a position of leadership when he could not fly in the unit that he was in.
Right.
And we always felt that another person with equal rank should be filling that position.
Right.
So, I mean, that was my opinion. There were others that had the same opinion, and we felt that was unjust.
Okay.
Now, right at the end of my tour in Fort Polk, you know, and Fort Polk was a hellhole. People that were going to Fort Polk were not the people that had been in for a long period of time. They were younger people going to that place, and Fort Polk had just become a fort. It had been a camp prior to that. There was no housing on post. We all lived off post, except for a few enlisted people, and the support there was lousy.
You spent quite a long period of time there,
right? And so that concerned us, but we joked about it, and we made the very best of it. And our families enjoyed us home, and we enjoyed being with our families. The group, the unit, had a great time, and there's a great deal of esprit there, too. Every one of us, except for one pilot, had just returned or had been in Vietnam in their last assignment. Now, there were other pilots, again, that were in assignments of long duration in areas that were sought after by many people, and they could not get it. Well, my choice, my first choice in life with the military is when they call me. Well, it was the second time. They asked me if I wanted to go when I was in the 498 back to Vietnam with the 498. And I said no. And that's when it went to Fort Polk. Then they asked when I was at Fort Polk, and they did ask, are you ready to go back to Vietnam? And I said, no, I'm not ready to go back to Vietnam. If you want me to go on a short tour, I'll go to Korea. And that satisfied them. And what I was really doing, I was avoiding, I wanted to avoid ever having to go back to Vietnam again.
Right.
Because I, as I look back at it, while I was there, it wasn't so bad. But when I look back at it, I knew that I had experienced something and for some reason came home safely.
Right.
And I was fearful that if I went back, I wouldn't make it back. So I went to, I made that choice. I went to the 377th Medical Company in Korea. And we had three pilots in Korea at that time. All of had been to Vietnam. Tom Jackson was the commander at that time. He had been over in Vietnam the first tour in 62-63. Had been one of the officers that had brought the 57th Medical Detachment over to Vietnam with Captain Trent, Temporelli, who was his commander in those days. But Tom Jackson was there. Another pilot was Charlie Clark. Charlie Clark had been to Vietnam with me and had come in with the 82nd and had been shot in the ankle and returned to CONUS, America, when he was wounded in Vietnam, and then myself. So, again, in each one of us had been in the States a short period of time and had been asked had we wanted to go back to Vietnam. And we basically made the choice to go to Korea.
Okay. You, now, just for the record, you went in January 1967.
Right.
And were there until March 1968.
Right.
So tell me what your basic duties were there in Korea.
Since there were so few pilots, we did have one non-rated pilot or person there who was an administrative officer. Tom Jackson was the commander. Charlie Clark was the maintenance officer, and I was the operations officer.
Okay.
I had responsibility over running the airfield, and we had another company there. So I was airfield operations officer overseeing the flights of both units there. We had our own operations people that regulated our own flights, but I was kind of the overseer of the airfield.
Okay.
And that meant many things. When you're operations officer, you, number one, have to make sure that your pilots get all of their training, their flying time, their minimum requirements. And we had no problems meeting minimums because we flew a lot at night and we flew a lot during the daytime.
What city were you based in?
We were in a complex called Alpha 102.
Okay.
And the A stood for airfield, and the 102 just happened to be a number that was tagged for that particular complex during the Korean War. Now, there was a hospital that was very close on a separate compound, and ASCOM City, ASCOM stands for Army Command Support, and it has all the logistics to support the Army that was assigned to Korea.
Okay.
So if there were big pieces of equipment to repair equipment, it was stored there. And it, they had other storage sites, but the hospital was there, and we were located fairly close so that we would fly all of our patients into that one particular hospital.
Sir, were you serving civilian or military patients, or both?
We primarily in Korea served all military, both American and Korean forces.
Okay.
Now, one thing that was unusual, again, we didn't have very many aircraft. As you remember, the 498 had 25 aircraft. And that was a company. Now, here in Korea, we only had three aircraft. We had very few pilots, three as I've indicated. We had one Huey, and its tail number was 0920. And we had a 23, two 23s, and that was it. We had a backup CH-21, which is the old banana ships that we became rated in. They are tandem rotor rated aircraft
mm-hmm.
that we learned to fly in case our Huey was down or one of our 23s were down.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we flew night missions with the small aircraft, which was an observation aircraft, and we flew patients on the outside of the aircraft in litters that they used during the Korean War.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this was almost in the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
So we had to, number one, fly in very, very bad terrain under snow conditions
mm-hmm.
in aircraft that were not rated for instrumentation, and those observation aircraft really weren't,
mm-hmm.
with one pilot
mm-hmm.
and a medic. The Huey was a good aircraft. We flew it all over. We were the only pilots that could fly along the DMZ. In other words, we had special check rides to fly into the deep militarization zone,
mm-hmm.
Which was a very small corridor at night under weather conditions.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, I was the only IP that could take the other Army pilots that happened to be there and train for night flying in that area for a period of time.
Did you ever have any incidents along the DMZ while you were flying there?
No.
Okay.
Now, there have been other pilots that have been fired upon
mm-hmm.
in that area,
mm-hmm.
but I would say that, well, I would speculate that if we were fired upon, it was that the pilot had gotten really too close
mm-hmm.
To the barbed wire,
mm-hmm.
I mean to the line, and was not necessarily totally in South Korean soil.
Right.
The other thing that I did that I really enjoyed, the South Korean Air Force started getting UH-1Hs, the most advanced helicopter at that time into Korea. Now, their pilots had 7, 8, 9,000 hours, lots of hours, and they had flown H-19s.
Mm-hmm.
I was selected to develop a training program for them, and I flew with the Korean Air Force training those pilots for quite a long time,
mm-hmm.
probably over 3 months during my period of stay there.
How did you find the Koreans?
Koreans are much like Vietnamese, are Asiatic people. They're a very humble people. They are willing to do what you ask them to do.
Mm-hmm.
You have to be reasonable with them. They do not like flying at night, just like most people don't like flying at night.
Mm-hmm.
It's just because they haven't been trained to fly at night.
Mm-hmm.
So I found that they were superb pilots and respected you as an individual, especially if you had special talents and you were helping their people.
Right.
And I got a very nice, beautiful plaque from them, from the president of South Korea
mm-hmm.
For doing that.
Okay.
For that short period of time. But it developed a good relationship between, I felt, the Air Force there
mm-hmm.
and us.
Right.
And the reason we were trying and wanted to, we were picking up lots of Korean wounded 50 of them. We called them Article 15 injured. Mm-hmm. If they were punished by their leaders, they might get sometimes the butt end of a weapon. Mm-hmm. But they would have a lot of training, accidents in tanks, et cetera. We were having to pick up all of their patients and flying them. And at times, we had to make decisions based on the type of patient we had to pick up. We had some conflict of picking up Americans versus Koreans. Obviously, we always, our primary mission was to support Americans, but we tried to do both. Mm-hmm. And that's hard when you have very few assets to do the job.
Right. Let me ask you a question. While you were there, the Tet Offensive occurred in Vietnam. What did you hear about that? This is in early 1968.
That they were continuing to build up the amount of forces that were in Vietnam, mm-hmm. and our feeling was that the American soldiers or the American leaders were not allowed to do battle as they had been trained to do battle,
okay.
and that they did not have adequate support or resources to do battle as they needed to do battle. So we felt that the American government was not adequately supporting the American fighting forces.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Now, again, from a selfish standpoint, mm-hmm. the people that were in Korea were already getting queried about going back to Vietnam,
right.
as soon as we finished the Korean tour.
Mm-hmm.
So that continued to raise the ugly head.
Mm-hmm.
Now, obviously, what I wanted to do was go to the career course. It was time for me to do that. And I wanted to get additional training in medical supply or logistics.
Mm-hmm.
I was interested in doing that.
Mm-hmm.
But all of the pilots, again, I must emphasize, that were going to Korea at the time had been to Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
or they were getting a short tour right out of flight school. My replacements... there was one pilot that had just come out of flight school, went to Korea. So it was the young pilots that was trying to make their name that were having to go on these hardship tours.
Mm-hmm. Now, did your refusal or your kind of not really wanting to go to Vietnam and communicating that to your superior officers, was that something that was looked down upon? Was that a matter of controversy, or did they treat it as, okay, we understand why you don't want to do that, and you, since you're one of the more senior pilots, we'll send the young ones first?
Well, I think we were bold enough to say why we didn't want to go.
Mm-hmm.
We wanted to wait our turn. And the people that was in the assignment branch did not hold that against us.
Okay.
And the record spoke for itself. And I'm truly glad that my front end was stacked with all those juicy assignments,
mm-hmm.
Because that paid off from my personal standpoint, not military necessarily,
mm-hmm.
but from a personal standpoint, I was able to get promoted much quicker. In fact, 2 times below the zone.
Mm-hmm.
And it was because I had those assignments on the front end,
right.
and not on the back end.
Right, right.
My career.
You had intense military combat experience there for the first year of your career.
Of course, after Korea, I did return to Fort Sam Houston.
Mm-hmm. This is in March 1968.
And I went to the Korea course, and I finished that
mm-hmm.
in December, I think, of that year.
Mm-hmm.
And I was able to convince them, since I was at Fort Sam, and there was a school starting in the material logistics division mm-hmm. that I would like to be able to go to. And since all of my short tours, or the two short tours that I had,
mm-hmm.
They said, well, if that's what you want to do, you can do it.
Okay.
So I went to the material management course after the advanced course.
Mm-hmm.
There were people in our... let me just tell you a little bit more about Medical Service Corps.
Sure.
It was a small corps anyway. Medical Service Corps, though, in the career course that I went to,
mm-hmm.
there were very few officers other than, I think we had about 8 aviators in my class. We had 3 sections, and I think they tried to separate us, and they put about 2 or 3 in each section,
mm-hmm.
The pilots. Number one, so we could give them a different experience of what was happening from the air standpoint versus the ground. But most of our classmates had not gone to Vietnam.
Right.
And they were already going to the career course. I mean, just like us.
Mm-hmm.
And they got there, some of them quicker than we did, because they were in an assignment where they could rotate right into the career course. So there were people that were captains at that point in time in 68, and the war had been going on for 6 years at that
mm-hmm.
point, since 62,
mm-hmm.
that had never been to Vietnam.
Okay.
So, again, I'm talking more about assignments, but that caused some dissension or some conflict with our own corps, I think.
Okay.
But, you know, we looked at it, I guess, from this standpoint. We were getting $100 more a month.
Mm-hmm.
We were getting a lot of glamour. I mean, if you went to the bar at night on happy hour,
mm-hmm.
Probably more people talked to you than some of the other folks
mm-hmm.
about experiences and that kind of thing. So
right.
you were able to, I guess, gloat in your success.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think the U.S. government was not sending the younger pilots over? It appears as though you and your older pilot friends thought that they should be doing.
Right. I think there wasn't a truly yet a commitment. And around 67 or 68 is when we really started putting an awful lot of, we put everything we had there.
Yes, sir.
And up until that time, they just didn't feel that we were going to be there at a duration.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I don't know. I there's just a lack of resources being placed there. We were in a particular specialty that demanded a great deal. And I have to look at it this way.
Mm-hmm.
If you join an aviation outfit,
mm-hmm.
you are going to either benefit or have some hard assignments that other people are not going to share
mm-hmm.
because of your training. If I were a special forces officer, I'd do that same type of assignment in a different way, but there would be very few people doing that particular job.
Mm-hmm.
What we had quite a few specialists, long-range patrol people that were doing certain jobs that were staying there a lot or rotating very quickly. There was a other issue, too. For example, the Marines, they were rotating their units in at six-month intervals.
Mm-hmm.
So what they were trying to do, they were trying to get everybody over to share in the experience, also get the people back so they could rest and recoup, but they were rotating entire units and then bringing them out and replacing them with new units.
Right.
And that was working quite well. And it gave them a break, because truly, if you could get a 2-week break, you felt better.
Mm-hmm.
The tour didn't seem as long. You were able to recoup, see loved ones, and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, that's just a different branch of the service, though, and we held it, we did it in a different way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It was mostly in Vietnam, the first part of the tour, a special forces operation.
Right.
Behind the train, the armies and the Air Force of Vietnam, how to support themselves without American forces.
Mm-hmm.
And that phase did not work. So we had to change phases or tactics on what we would do. And then we decided, and again, I don't know when it was exactly, but say during the 67-68 time frame,
mm-hmm.
that we could not do it just with Vietnamese forces doing their own thing.
Mm-hmm.
We had to go in and do battle ourselves with our own forces and with our own capabilities. The second step of that phase never totally happened, because the second part was let the services do their job as they were trained with no limitations.
Mm-hmm.
And we had limitations on engagement. We had limitations on bombing missions.
Mm-hmm.
We had limitations on encountering the enemy.
Mm-hmm.
We had limitations on tactics. So if we could have moved into that second phase, we might have been able to do better.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in the meantime, with our procrastination, the North Vietnamese Army became very strong, and they had lots of people that they could throw at the war.
Mm-hmm.
And they did.
Do you think the United States should have taken ground troops into North Vietnam?
Yes.
Okay. What about the threat of Chinese intervention?
Could have happened.
I'm sorry?
I said that could have happened.
Just like Korea.
Right. We had to pull back in Korea, too.
Mm-hmm.
We've never, we had to pull back in Desert Storm.
Mm-hmm.
If we would, I know we're not supposed to talk about the future but or past, but
no,
those are three incidents where we did not kill the enemy.
Mm-hmm.
Or we did not complete the action.
Mm-hmm.
We did not take over.
Do you think the United States should have used all means necessary to win, such as using atomic weaponry and invading, say, Cambodia and Laos?
Nuclear weaponry is not a good avenue.
Mm-hmm.
I would never say that that would be an appropriate action.
Okay.
I cannot support that.
Okay.
But I can support the other capabilities that the forces had. Mm-hmm. We could not legally go into Laos.
Right.
We could not legally go into Cambodia. Now, we had long-range LRPs doing things, snoops doing things, but not really
mm-hmm.
Anything that would take care of the enemy.
Mm-hmm.
Can I take a break?
Absolutely, sir.